a little bit, but not the science information business.
I must say they did fairly well. Ted's a very clever man. He probably had Thompson in mind when he did that. And he knew that they would pay a good price, and he thought a good fit for them because they have Derwent and so on. And they were smart enough to utilize my expertise for whatever was necessary. And the irony of it is, of course, that all these moves that they made, I also benefited financially. Although they tried to do me in out of several million dollars, and some part of it they succeeded. But it's a different company. And there were a lot of people left, terminated. So the culture has changed.
Now the progression stock-wise is when you hired the guy who was CEO, all the stock arrangements were still the same.
Yeah.
It was when you went to the partnership that you
got... It was because of Marty Kenny that I didn't realize that these friends of Maxwell were buying the stock, and we were supposed to buy that stock from them. I had to write a first refusal.
Yeah.
Heard that they were trying to sell it, and so
nobody offered it to you as they were supposed to.
No, he was acting. There was I told them to buy the stock, and they never did it. And then I got a letter from Maxwell Hoyer.
Okay.
So this led me to think there's something going on there.
So when you went to the partnership, is when you gave up majority ownership.
That's correct.
And then
JPT is the name of the company. Joe, Paul, and Ted. But they were all publishing. Joe Palazzolo had worked for Ted in various capacities.
And they then sold out to Thompson.
That's right.
And you
that took about 3 or 4 years.
Right now, you still had your 40%.
Yeah, and I got compensated for that. But then I had a contract a 5-year contract of one kind or another.
For advice
I paid off. Then I no longer was an employee. I was a consultant, and that's where I'm at now. I'm essentially. So I have no say whatsoever in this company. I mean, I'm treated very nicely. I don't complain about that.
Do you regret selling?
Do I regret? I regret the circumstances that led up to it. And I regret that I did not take actions to guarantee that certain things would not occur. But other than that, you can't have it both ways. I mean, I at some point I had to get some money. I had exhausted the possibilities of using my salary to get any. I didn't even own my own home at the time. The company owned it. The apartment that I had was owned by the company. I had to buy that apartment back from ISI. I paid the highest price for it. But in any event, what do I regret? It would have been nice if I had children who were capable of taking over. But one of my sons worked here for a while. He's now a computer analyst, and he just wasn't suited to this. And the other son is not interested. And not a question of dynasty or anything like that. Maybe if I, my present son is, my youngest son is 12 and a half. What would it matter? 10 years from now, he would have come and work here. No. My wife was vice president at the time, but I mean, theoretically. But I don't think she would have wanted to continue. As I said, I think that I should have taken better precautions about what they were going to do about the scientist and what was going to be done about the child care center and a few other things that I didn't think of. But other than that, I've been, financially, I've done very well. Could have done better and so forth, maybe. The longer you hold out, the better your price generally is. So I held out, what, for 30 years?
Yeah.
That's long. But I, you know, I took that part of that money and I set up the foundation. Well, you wouldn't be sitting here if I didn't have that foundation.
Right? What strikes me is that you're a classic case, and maybe even more classic than usual, of the person who loved the business and created products that served a useful purpose, and that feeling sort of was the core business, really. Even though there were the products, it was that feeling about trying to advance the purposes of science and the purpose of documentation / information science. And is that feeling still there within the company? Or, and just looking at the folks who came up at the same time as you in the information business generally, have we seen?
Well, I can't speak to the motives of the executives in this company. I'm sure that every one of them takes satisfaction out of ISI's products and feels a certain amount of service to their clientele. I mean, they're no different than any other business people. I think that, there's amongst them, they're always going to be mercenaries. But I'm sure they enjoy being able to... Bill Schlegel was a very financially oriented guy, but, I mean, he always told me repeatedly how great it was to be in a company where it was so visibly obvious that you were performing a useful service, that you weren't just a me-too. Okay? Now, if this company went out of business, it would be felt. I mean, everything was shut down, somebody else would have to restart it, right? That's the key to it. It's not as though you're out there selling, you got a luncheonette, and if your luncheonette closes, people go to another luncheonette. That's the difference. Not that those people are not entitled to feel satisfaction in their clientele, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody serves in their own individual way. But I think there are a lot of tools that still can be developed out of this database that will be of enormous interest and satisfaction to a lot of people. The internet and so on. Lots of stuff can happen. So, they're going to do it. They're going to make a profit because Thompson paid a good price and they got to get their money back. And they're entitled to it. I don't begrudge him that. In fact, I do everything in my power to help him make it. Even though I get nothing out of it, the better the company does, the happier I am. I don't begrudge anybody. I mean, if I want to invest in Thompson, I could. I don't. I mean, if you invested in their stock, I don't think you'd have done all that well over the years. They're not that well. I don't know who invested in them, but. You just invest in the S&P 500. You do very well today, that's all.
Yeah, for a while, right? Yeah.
No, over the long term, you'll do very well,
right,
too.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Although you do better with a good small cap fund.
Yeah. Gosh, you have to tell me when to call for how hungry you are, or I've got about...
Oh, I didn't even think of that. I so rarely eat lunch that I don't...
Oh,
think.
Is that right? Okay, well, good. If you don't mind, about another 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
In 63, you made an appearance before a congressional committee holding hearings on whether to establish a National Research Data Processing and Information Retrieval Center.
Right.
That name was incredible.
Yeah.
And you discussed the chaos in scientific communication. But what I can't tell, and you also have troubles with the development of information science, talk about that. What I can't tell is whether you were really in favor of establishing that center. From reading your testimony, you seem to have mixed views. Now, by 63, you've got the company going along real well, and now the big leap is coming with GCI and SCI. Am I reading this correct in terms of you have some mixed feelings about the establishment of this kind of center by the federal government?
Maybe. Probably, because I've always had these mixed feelings. Like, I'm having a conversation right now with some guy, email conversation, about he wants the government to provide free access to all of its databases and so forth. And I say it's a mixed blessing. You know, as a citizen who pays for it, I feel, yeah, it'd be nice to have it available. But on the other hand, it can be a real deterrent to innovation. Okay? And in spite of all the resources that they've had, I don't think that NLM and all of them are all that innovative. I mean, if you had the money they've had and the resources they've had, I think you could have done too. Maybe. Not that I'm criticizing Don Lindbergh. They do a terrific job in their context, you know. But a lot more could be done, much better.
Mm-hmm.
I think. So, yeah, I have ambivalent. Maybe that center would have been serviced by a lot of outside companies. I don't know. The databases that they would use would maybe be licensed from other people. You know.
Well, you make one argument that kind of intrigued me. You said maybe what should happen is that each individual scientist should be given a stipend so that he or she can buy their own information services.
Right.
Was that your middle ground? That is, the entrepreneurs could get some support?
Yeah, right. Sure, because especially now, if Medline's going to be free, you got some money left over then to buy something that's not free. Yeah. I still, now, in theory, scientists can still do that. Theoretically, they used to very easily take money out of the research grants and buy current contents. That was a big, big discovery that I made. And that was one of the keys to the success of this business. I discovered that there was a provision in that they could buy research materials. And so I used to put, and I got somebody to tell them that they could do this. And we used to put that on our brochures. It's perfectly legal to charge current contents to your research grant.
Neat. So that became part of your marketing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also in this testimony, you talked about your 61 trip to see
Moscow?
To see Venedi. Talk about that trip, how it happened.
I went there for the internet. It was a biochemistry congress. I was one of 500 Americans who were there for the International Congress of Biochemistry.
Hmm. So, how did you get invited to see Venedi, or just?
I don't even remember how that occurred. If it occurred in 61.
You said you went.
I went there in 61.
Went through, right.
Yeah.
Said you were impressed in some ways, but other ways that the Congress folks were trying to press you on automation about them, but apparently you didn't see much automation taking place.
Right. It was true.
But no other impressions remain of Venedi. You seem to have liked that model in some ways.
Well, it was multidisciplinary, is what I say.
Mm-hmm.
A huge
number of people.
Well, it was not as many people as they alleged, because most of them were part-timers. They were the abstractors on the earth, out of there, you see. They didn't have 20,000 employees. They had, you know, like Chemical Abstracts has a list of abstractors. Okay? But still, they probably had a lot of employees, I'm sure. If I went there in 61, what did I have to show them other than current contents? So it must have been very brief. It was subsequently that I came back there a few years later.
Oh, you did? You visited again?
Oh, I was in Moscow many times.
Yeah. And touring
over the years. I was... we used to go to the Moscow Book Fair in the 60s, late in the 60s. Come in. Open the door. Lock.
Sorry.
Hi, Henry.
Hey. How are you doing? Are you guys in a big meeting? Can I just bring in Leo Eggie?
Lee. And, I just really, I think we finished pretty much of that. Let me ask you about the information science programs. In 63, there was an article, you seemed optimistic about programs like Georgia Tech and Drexel. You mentioned Penn, what you were doing at Penn. That they were going to offer graduates in information science that would really begin to deal with these significant and big-time problems. Has your optimism been come true?
What do you mean generally? By these big-time problems?
All of the kinds of putting together of the systems and of trying to make information science a real science. Related kinds of areas.
I suppose I imagine that, you know, there are a sufficient number of places that can accommodate any bright people that come along and they need to study and do whatever they have to do. I don't know where it's all going. I mean, so much of it is now related to the internet and machine system and so on. Difficult for me to say. I think that, you know, library science is clearly taking a turn. There are certain functions that still have to be done. I mean, it's like there's just this big lag between, you know, the poor section of the society that depends on public libraries for the way we did when we were kids, and there's the more advanced things that are being done with the computer network. I don't know. I just very, very rapidly changing situation. I always felt bad that they had to close these library schools, but I presume there were good reasons for it. I don't know. There's not that much of a demand. Is that, by the way, turning around? Is the internet spawned, I thought, a greater interest in library schools? Or is that not true?
No. I would say the thing you can see in the popular press these days is that all programs ought to be some combination of computer science and MIS business stuff. And indeed, that's been the focus of the new program that Michael Buckland's involved with at Berkeley. They've changed their name, and just like the school here, Drexel has changed its name, Michigan has changed its
College of Information Studies.
Right, or just the School of Information is what they call it at Michigan.
Uh-huh.
Michael Buckland's program at Berkeley is now called School of Information Management, I think.
So where will things like reference libraries go?
They probably stay in the traditional programs like mine.
Which will be called library programs.
No, we have been, and I consider my program to be toward the traditional end, unfortunately. It's become library and information science, and the internet stuff is there, but the research and development work in information science that dealing with problems of information retrieval and sophisticated computer modeling and those kinds of things mostly is taking place in schools of computer science, which may call themselves, by the way, in fact, the Georgia Tech one is a good example. It, from the beginning, called itself School of Information Science, but looks more like a computer science program. And that's why I was wondering if you were, say, more optimistic, less optimistic, or just views about that.
I don't know what to say to that. I don't have any strong feeling one way or the other. I think that clearly, with everything that's been done, there's still going to be a need for people to refine all these systems and how it gets done. Drawing in people with all kinds of backgrounds and disciplines.
What do you think the internet's going to do to all of this?
Well, I hope that it would just make a lot more people interested in the kinds of problems that we face when we're doing literature searching. I think that it's kind of been so separate from our involvement. The average scientist today, if he's going to have full text and everything available, he's going to have to learn how to search those things. He's going to want to have to exploit it. He's going to find out what's right and what's wrong with it. I would like to see more. I mean, hopefully Free Medline will get these guys so involved with it and say, oh, geez, this is a crappy system. Why doesn't it permit me to find this and that? So, whatever, chemical abstract. The closer, the more you can get these users involved in using these systems. I mean, today the big problem is the dichotomy between the free and the paid. Of course, it's free now for all the academics because the universities are going to pay for it on licenses, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So the end user should have access to these things, and I would think that a lot of good could come out of that. I think that, unfortunately, it's now in a stage where it's totally frustrating. You get on here, and the delays are... I mean, I don't know what's going to happen there. I guess eventually it'll force more capacity to come in. But,
are we in the information field going to be in more demand, hopefully get better, you think, as a result of the internet? Like you say, the free and wide availability of these things?
I hope so. I think that... whatever it is can be done with the existing apparatus that we use that can't be done on the internet, will somehow it all be converted to machine readable? Or, we've got to bridge the gap between the present and the past. I mean, I think that we're going to look, they're going to be scanners, it'll make things going to be cheaper and cheaper to convert everything to make it machine readable. I mean, I can tell even my own self, when I got to go over there to use those printed indexes that are sitting in here, I mean, for all intents and purposes, this is like a decoration. But occasionally there's something comes up that I have to do, which I cannot easily do on this thing. And I just walk over and pull a book out and open it up. But I then say, oh my God, I got to now spend the next 10 minutes looking up these source items. And you balk at that. I don't want to get somebody else to do it.
Not to mention going back or forward in time from that point.
In the old days when we had nothing else, we were conditioned to doing it that way. I didn't think anything of sitting here for 15 minutes copying out a bunch of references or whatever.
Yeah. I tell my students, I said, used to we'd spend hours standing at the card catalog sorting. Now if the computer doesn't respond in 5 seconds, we're drumming our fingers impatiently.
So we have heightened expectations, and so I would hope that we could find a way to convert all this old stuff so that it too will be used along with the new stuff. It would be a tragedy if it wasn't. And there's clearly still a need for it to get back into the older stuff and be able to make those links and do these. Contemporary history of science, I think, could be done in such a... We ought to still be able to do what I've always said we could do with our databases. And they are, hopefully it'll all be integrated. You know, they have all these links to... So you don't have gaps. And you won't have to differentiate between Medline and chemical abstracts and all that. We've got a long way to go before that happens. Right? Although some of the things that CA has been doing with the different databases, you know, you can do a search that's kind of like your... Mm-hmm. It's like a dial index of... that's what
right.
we need, you know.
Right, yeah.
And how all that gets resolved financially and with all these profit-making companies, I don't know. It's a real challenge. So, you know, you realize as the years go by, the problems are endless, and you're never going to be able to do all of them. Never going to be able to do all the projects I thought I could do and want to do.
What are your regrets?
Regrets? I don't have regrets about anything.
No?
What's the point? What's the point?
I didn't just...
You did what you thought was best at the time. And if you made a mistake, it's done. It's over. And what can be done to rectify it?
By regrets, I don't mean sorry, but instead, gosh, I intended to work on that project, but it didn't look like it was going to make any money, and it's too bad, or that kind of regret.
A lot of things that I know. I remember years and years ago, we said we were going to have somebody create a citation index of... at least the medical journals of the 19th century. And this is a project that involved doing something like Henry Small did on the Physics Citation Index from the 20s. Going through and extracting citations because they were implicit. They weren't all written out. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe when it was all through, might be a couple dozen medical historians who would use it. History of American Medicine.
Yeah.
Why do people do these things? Well, now, maybe it would be possible to scan in all those journals and have them in an archive of American medical history and then do all these full text things with them, you know, and citation linking, whatever. Now, with all the citation linking that you can do with all this thing, it's still interesting that you're still going to need a citation index as such if you want to see it all together. I mean, you'll be able to, you can link, jump. I don't know whether that's going to be sufficient as a replacement for a citation index. In other words, that ultimate catalog record. The catalog record is the source work, what it cites, all the trails from there, and what cites it, and all the trails from there. So that's what the catalog entry should be.
Preferably
for a book or an article.
Preferably with hypertext links to the full text.
Well, of course,
yeah.
That's what it means.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, that's how you have a link.
Yeah. That would be a very nice library.
Well, we'll see.
Information system.
And there are going to be a lot of problems along the way when you do that.
Yeah, right.
How long that's all going to take, I don't know. I hope I'm around to see some of it.
I hope you are, too.
Be interesting 10 years from now to see how far this comes. I don't know. Yeah. Things don't move as quickly as we like to think.
Both that impression, but the other impression is how quickly they do move, and that must have been the case with you also, because...
Yeah.
You've now got 45 years.
Well, a lot to go back, though, to do over again, in a sense. You know, I mean, who knows? If I had my way, there would be a government WPA project to go back and citation index all the literature that was ever published. Okay? I try to encourage, like, I heard as this Chinese student out in L.A. tells me there's a Chinese citation index.
Is that right?
They started one, apparently, a couple of years ago. I've never heard anything, seen of it, but... The Russians, had, before Professor Nalimov died, he wrote to me and said somebody in Russia was interested in doing a citation index. Russian, you know, particularly arts and humanities. Well, where are they going to get the money? I mean, but I mean, they got all kinds of manpower.